The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. So, one of the important features of a human life, probably your life, is stories. And the stories that you live in. And you probably have told yourself a lot of stories. And you're probably still living in some of your stories. And whether all your stories are accurate is for you to decide. Stories of the past, stories of the future, stories of the present. And religions, and Buddhism here is considered religion, can also be seen as traditions of storytelling. And probably the success of religions has more to do with the stories they tell than the particular, you know, philosophical or theological doctrine they give. And often the doctrine is embedded in the stories that are told. And Buddhism also has stories. And stories of Buddhism are partly has to do with success, stories of enlightenment and things like that. But one of the peculiar things about the stories that are told in the Buddhist tradition is that some of them are maybe great stories that lead us to the end of stories. Or say it a little bit differently, that we tell the stories to help bring the storyteller to an end. And the storyteller. So not just your stories, but when you're telling stories in your mind and privately to yourself, you're the storyteller. And what does it mean to bring the storyteller to an end, to let the storyteller become peaceful? Because if we don't do that, and we keep being the storyteller, and we believe the storyteller, and we're caught up in the perpetual activities of being the storyteller, our stories, sooner or later, will be too limiting to really represent the life we're living, and we'll end up stressed or challenged by it. And so if it's just a matter of telling yourself a new story, a better story, you know, that's not really ultimately that hopeful, but rather there's something very profound about bringing the storyteller to rest. So maybe I'm going to tell a story today. And it's a story that, you know, maybe it's told in the very ancient story in Buddhism, goes back to the earliest times. Maybe it has some basis in fact. But even so, it's probably almost more useful to think of it as a fairy tale or a myth than it is, you know, this is really what happened. And because seeing it as a fairy tale or a myth, then you're more likely, the hope is, then you're more likely going to identify with the story and not hold it as, oh, how could that, you know, that's ridiculous. Or, that's politically incorrect. And but rather if you see it as kind of mythic, maybe archetypes even, then the question is, how do these myths work in your life? Do they have some place, time and place for which they work? So this story concerns a man named Yasa, young man, son of very wealthy parents, the time of the Buddha. And he became the first layperson to ordain as a Buddhist monk after the Buddha's enlightenment, just some weeks afterwards, supposedly. And so it's a story of him discovering the Buddha and discovering the teachings and eventually getting enlightened in the story. And the story says that this young son of wealthy parents, who had so wealthy that they had three palaces, one for each of the three seasons in India. And so they would move around to the different palaces for the different seasons just to have the optimal conditions. And he had every possible sense pleasure. this young man. And he had gold slippers. So to have gold on your feet is pretty, means in three palaces and every possible sensual pleasure. He was living a life of great opulence. And so maybe you could imagine, you know, maybe this is a fairy tale, but we certainly have people here in Silicon Valley who live lives that way. Some of them have at least three homes, one for every season, in San Francisco, Patola Valley, Lake Tahoe, in Maui, you know. And there are such people, and there are people who get raised in that kind of environment. I have a friend who is son now is in the Woodside Elementary School, and I was told this 15 years ago or so, 10 years ago, that the family income of some of the grades, to add it all together, all the family income, some of the grades in Woodside High School, elementary school, is greater than some African countries. Isn't that amazing? So there are, you know, sometimes these are myths, right? And sometimes these myths become true. And people grow up in these kinds of environments, very privileged. And the problem with, I know as parents of kids in the Woodside Elementary School, when they don't live lives of opulence, it's very hard for the kids because most of the kids around them are. And so it's very challenging to kind of socialize, and you get certain values that maybe don't serve the kids in the long run. Maybe they do, I don't know. But so this man, in time of the Buddha, was this young man living this kind of life. And so then he, one night he was partying. And he had all the possible attendants to party with that you could imagine. Most of them young and beautiful women. Many of them musicians who played great music, dancers who danced. And, you know, they say in the text that he was enjoying every possible sensual pleasure. And you can probably imagine the range. And yesterday, I just happened by coincidence to be in Berkeley during what was called Cal Day. Don't drive into Berkeley on Cal Day. It took a long time to get in and a long time to get out. The traffic is quite something. It's the day, I guess, where they invite all the alumni, I guess. I don't know, or people to come to UC Berkeley. And so but I didn't know any of this. So then we ended up driving to go up into the hills above Berkeley for a hike. But it happened to be, had to drive right by, I guess, like Fraternity Row, with all these fraternities. And I said, what's so many people out? I said, what's going on here? I hadn't realized yet it was Cal Day. And some of it was great to see all these young people, kind of vital, you know, the youth. There's a beauty in youth and energy and vitality and exuberance. And, you know, it was really great to see all these, you know, college students doing their lives and being happy. But then I started driving by some of the fraternities, and one of them had all these security guards outside. Why do you need security guards at a fraternity party? I thought that was... Oh, we have trouble hearing in the back? Are you able to turn up this volume in the back? The outer hall? And I wonder, is the speaker out there actually on? I mean, the outer hall?
It's very low.
It's very low. If you have trouble, is that a little bit better? You can also use the hearing system devices, which are in the box on the counter there, and maybe that would help you far out in the back. It sounds like you turned up everything, but now it's loud in here. Are you okay in here?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So, and then I started seeing people drinking, and they seemed happy. But I remembered when I was in college and some of the hangovers and some of the ways in which some of these parties went, and And I'm glad I'm not doing them anymore. So then, so this man Yasa partied through the night and everyone fell asleep. And he was the first one to wake up. And so he looked around and he saw all these, the way the text described it, all these young women laying akimbo, laying kind of all in disarray on the floor, sleeping, with their all disheveled with their hair and their makeup and their clothes. And some of them were dribbling, you know, and some of them were muttering in their sleep, I guess, in an unbecoming way. And it was not a pretty scene. And Yasa then exclaimed something which in the ancient language probably means something like it's a calamity, or it's oppressive, or it's dangerous. He said, oh, what a calamity, what a calamity. So he literally said the word this is a calamity, this is a calamity. So he kind of ran off, I guess, to get out of there. Went to the local kind of grove of trees, little park or something where the Buddha was living. And he came to by the Buddha and he said, this is a calamity, this is a calamity. This is oppressive, this is oppressive. And the Buddha, probably sitting there peacefully, quietly, probably quite a contrast to the scene he'd left, to this person who was sitting upright, alert, probably under a beautiful tree, living a life of simplicity. And the Buddha replied to Yasa and he said, this is not a calamity. This is not a calamity. Or this is not oppressive. This is not oppressive. So what is the this in these two exclamations? This for Yasa probably had to do with, you know, the life he was living in the palace. This for the Buddha, what is that? When he said, no, this is not a calamity, this is not. Is he talking about this world we live in? Is he talking about the life he was living right there and then? So one way or the other, the Buddha offered something different. This is not oppressive. This is not dangerous. And so that got Yasa's attention. Perhaps he felt quite hopeful that someone was offering a different perspective on life, a different way of being, something. And so he sat down, and the Buddha gave him a teaching that was the first time he gave a set of teachings that became a common thing that he would teach people. And you find records of him doing so over and over again. We don't have the details of this teaching, but the Buddha, it's called a gradual discourse. And the Buddha first gave teachings about generosity. And then he gave teachings on virtue. And then he gave teachings on what's divine. And then he gave teachings about the vanity and danger of sensual pleasure. And then he gave teachings on renunciation. So generosity, virtue, the divine, the dangers of sensual pleasure, and the benefits of renunciation. And in the course of giving that teaching to him, Yasa's mind became peaceful, soft, receptive, workable, malleable. And when the Buddha saw that Yasa's mind was in such a good state, inspired state, then the Buddha gave Yasa the teachings which are, as the texts say, are particular to the Buddhas. That which is really unique to the Buddhas, because teachings on generosity and virtue and so forth, you know, a lot of people can teach those. So the Buddha was going to offer something different. And when Yasa sat down to hear what that different thing was, he started to offer this series of things that changed Yasa's mind. Not radically, not didn't transform it, but changed it enough to make him receptive to hear something really profound. That which leads to the end of the storyteller. And so first he talked about generosity. And if you have in the context of this, the background, that the Buddha is going to teach about what is not oppressive, what is not dangerous, what is not a calamity. So the first thing he taught was generosity. Generosity is, is a really an amazingly important act in our society. Each of us have been the recipient of generosity, lots of generosity, one way or the other. Not few people, like myself, it was only when we became parents did we have any clue what our parents must have done for us. You know, even if our parents were bad parents, at some point we kind of, how could they? When they must have cared for us as babies. An amount of work and care, wow, that was pretty something. They gave a lot. Mr. Rogers, one of my great heroes, Mr. Rogers must have been the American saint, the American Buddha. Mr. Rogers, those who don't know, was a person, it was actually a Christian minister who discovered his ministry was to offer a children's program for young kids. He did it for decades. And all these wholesome values, goodness, came through. He would just kind of present goodness to little kids as they grew up in a way that I discovered him as, and only really discovered him when I had young kids. I missed him growing up. And I was really touched by Mr. Rogers. But there's a story that Mr. Rogers was once given an award, like an Academy Award, an Oscar or something, for his years of television work and what he did. And so he went on stage and he was going to give a little speech and all these TV cameras. And I guess lots of people watch these things on TV, right? It's a big thing in America. And so he got up and he gave a little speech and he said, we're all here today, one way or other, because of someone's generosity to us. Someone's benefited us. Someone believed in us. Why don't we take a minute to be quiet and silent to think about who believed in us, whose generosity supported us so we're here today? And so then he was silent on national TV for a minute. And the producer of this thing probably was horrified, like, what? The attention span of TV audience. Excuse me. Sorry. It was off, but there's a delay in the button here. So they panned the TV camera through the audience, this great award in Los Angeles, and because they had to do something with the TV. And people were crying, and to have that evoked. So to be the recipients of generosity, to feel the generosity of people, to be generous and to experience the benefit of it, some of you, it's a beautiful thing, simple acts of generosity to people we love and care for. And sometimes it's so easy and so natural to kind of hear, let me do this for you and offer you this. And it's a kind of a, it's not a calamity. It's not a dangerous, not an oppression to offer and give and in a generous way. I once offered to take a friend to the airport. She was leaving town. And she said no. I knew it was a little drag for her to find her way there. And I offered a couple of times, not too pushy, I think. And she kept saying no. And I said, okay. So I didn't. But I felt a little bit sad. Not because I didn't help her, but because of the goodness of my offer. It was actually a beautiful, simple, ordinary, nice thing I was offering to do. And it was kind of curtailed by her saying no. She didn't want to trouble me or something. It's a beautiful thing to offer and to be generous and to live in a world of generosity. And so the Buddha talked about this as the first step of, this is not a calamity, this is not a danger, this is not oppressive. A world of generosity. Very different than the world of partying or whatever. And then he talked about virtue. And I was a latecomer to appreciating the value of virtue. to really celebrate it, to feel joy of it. And I really came to appreciate it only because of my meditation practice, my retreat practice. That somehow the inner sense of peace, of settledness, of relaxation, of openness, of inner softness, inner non-conflict, inner being present, was such that it gave me a visceral reference point for what it's like inside, in the heart, to transgress ethically with people and cause harm in a way that I hadn't understood before. And so I got to appreciate virtue not as something like a commandment that you should, you know, should do this, but rather as a way that expresses and protects this innate goodness or well-being or peacefulness or settledness that can exist here in our own heart, in our own bodies here. And so to appreciate virtue that way, that this is not a calamity to live a virtuous life. This is not oppressive. This is not dangerous to avoid causing harm. And given how much hate we're reading about in the paper these days in the world, to live a virtuous life is to live a life that doesn't hate, doesn't act on hate. Hate is dangerous. And then the Buddha talked about what is divine. And we don't know what exactly he meant by this, but I like to believe that he talked about what's called sometimes in Buddhism the divine abodes, which is the Brahma Viharas, which is love, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. That to live a life not of hate, but to live a life of love, compassion, this is not a calamity. This is not dangerous. This is not oppressive. You're not going to go wrong through compassion. You're not going to go wrong by having wise love, where your heart has that capacity to radiate. Not necessarily romantic love, but kind of a universal love, that agape maybe, metta, where we can see the beauty of people and appreciate people for who they are and not protect ourselves from having an open heart to the people we encounter. This is not dangerous. So Yasa heard this teaching. And then, after this kind of maybe inspiring teaching, then he heard about the danger of sensual pleasure. And the Buddha used the word the vanity of sensual pleasure. Isn't that interesting? The vanity of it, or the conceit of sensual pleasure. And, you know, we have a society that's addicted. We have capacities for addiction in our modern society that have never existed before. You know, just the range of possibilities and the range of messages that are, that helping us get addicted to things. And now, you know, there's vaping. Vaping? Is that how you pronounce it? I've only read about it. What?
Vaping.
You know, so now vaping. I saw my first vaping ad at the Arco station. Vaping? You don't know what vaping is? Vaping is, I guess it stands for vapor. It's nicotine, which was put into vapor, and you smoke these electronic cigarettes. So you don't get a lot of the chemicals that exist in cigarettes, but you get the nicotine. But it's also very addictive. And they're targeting teens. And there's the number of teens vaping has gone up dramatically, apparently. So we have all these opportunities. And I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, I started teaching in the 90s, 1990 actually, and so I've been teaching now for 25 years. And I would say it's only in the last 10 years that one of the addictions that people come and talk to me about is pornography, that they're really troubled by this. And either people were too private before, and we're public with ourselves now, or because of the internet, it's much more available. And I've talked to people who have tremendous challenges because of the internet and the accessibility to pornography. And so the ability to be addicted, to be caught, I would suggest is stronger than it's ever been before. And so the dangers of those. One of the first people to tell me this was a young man who was an adult living with his parents. And his parents actually told him to leave. They said, you can't live here anymore because of how much pornography he was watching on the web. So that's a danger in your relationship to your parents, you know, and with addictions of all kinds. And you know, there's this temporary pleasures that can destroy lives. Temporary pleasures that destroy our, bring us pleasure but not well-being. In fact, sometimes the pleasure of addictions short-circuit or limit a capacity for a deep sense of well-being and happiness. And so I think in Buddhism it's not so much like you're a bad person if you're addicted or pursuing sensual pleasure. It tends not to be a moralistic religion, but there is a sobering analysis or appreciation for the dangers. And if pursuing sensual pleasure is not dangerous, sometimes it's not, then Buddhism doesn't say it's bad. You know, all sensual pleasures are not bad. But there are dangers. There is conceit that's in the whole pursuit of sensual pleasure. So remember, the Buddha was telling this to Yasa, this man who had it all. So it must have been sobering to really appreciate this, the danger of it. In a sense, the Buddha was agreeing with him. Yasa came to the Buddha and said, this is dangerous. And then the Buddha talked about the benefits of renunciation, which in a society like we find in the United States, it's not a particularly popular teaching, the idea of renunciation. But you have to remember the story that the Buddha was teaching was about the benefits of renunciation. So rather than how renunciation deprives you, the deprivations of renunciation, how it's going to lessen your life and diminish your life, the idea in Buddhism is that there's something, some act or some way of renunciation, of simplifying your life, that enhances your life, grows your life, benefits your life. Rather than becoming less of a person because you renounce, you become more in some ways, bigger, a bigger heart, bigger mind. And it's the attachment to sensual pleasure, to greed, to you know, clinging to things, that in some way, that's what diminishes our life. That's what undermines our life. There's something about renunciation, the spirit of renunciation, or the attitude of renunciation in Buddhism, is one that brings freedom and lightness and openness and clarity and ease into our life. And if it doesn't bring those kind of feelings, then it's not quite renunciation. The word renunciation, the nekamma, the Buddhist word for it, has a different connotation than maybe the English word renunciation. Etymologically, it means to go out. And the image that the Buddhists give is someone who's gone out into the wide open. And so the contrast I like to make is, you know, I'm sure your, you know, probably your family is a wonderful, your extended family is great, and you can assume that. But then you go up into the Sierras in a cabin, and you get snowed in for the winter, one room cabin with your extended family. And it's, you know, wonderful for a few hours and nice. But then after a while, like, you know, anybody, you spend 20, 25 people, I don't know how big your extended family is, you know, but like after a while, it's like, you know, wow, give me a break. And but it's all winter long until the snow melts. And then finally the snow melts and you can leave your cabin and you go out into the, you know, meadow, and it's like so good to be in the wide open again. You know, you're no longer claustrophobic. So that's kind of the connotations of the word nekamma, of renunciation. You're actually gaining the wide open rather than losing something in the act of renunciation. So certainly renunciation of attachment to sensual pleasure, attachment to self, attachment to telling stories. So all these attachments we let go of, renounce. And I think one of the most powerful acts of renunciation that many people could do is in fact renouncing their stories. And the question is, how many of your stories serve you? How many of the stories you tell about what happened to you, who you are, what's going to happen to you, do they really benefit you? Do they give you a good perspective on this life, on yourself? Are the stories you tell over and over again, are they dragging you down? Are they depressing you? Are they discouraging you? Are they telling you you're a bad person? Are they telling you that the world is dangerous? What are the stories you're living under? Even good stories can be oppressive. I've known people who, with tremendous effort and cost to their lives for decades, lived in told themselves a story of that this world is a like, you know, all flowers and sweet and sugar and pastoral and flower children everywhere. And holding on to that, and their life kind of falling apart around them. I know one person in particular, until finally she was, this was explained to her, what she was doing, you know, how she was holding the world was actually part of the reason why she had so much trouble with everyone. And then when she saw that, she said, oh, now it makes sense what's happening to me and why so many people are angry with me. And so then she let go of that, and her life was changed. Let go of that story, that things are all good. So you can imagine, maybe you can imagine Yasa hearing a new story from the Buddha. He had his story that he grew up with, and now he heard a different story. Story about generosity, virtue, the divine, love perhaps, the problems of sensual pleasures, and the story of renunciation. And then Buddha recognized that Yasa's mind was soft, receptive, inspired, ready to hear something. So you give, you know, so you imagine that it means that Yasa was carried along and was inspired and it touched him and it was meaningful for him what he heard. And I like to think that in this kind of teaching, giving up his stories, being settled, being right here, he probably evoked these states. Generosity is kind of like a state. Virtue is kind of like a state. It's not just ideas, it's a feeling of goodness. That love is a state. So, you know, the wisdom that sees the problems of desire and attachment is something that really brings you present in the present moment. All these things brings you here. Yasa was more and more just here, present. Present in himself, feeling this kind of states, feeling good about just being here. And this ability of gathering together, just being here with all this goodness, here with this settled way, here without the stories that are undermining us and depressing us and making things challenging. Just being here. And then this day of renunciation and renouncing our stories, the stories of what our attachments are going to do for us, the stories about why we have to resist and hold things at bay. So Yasa was getting more and more here, present for this time, this place. His mind was receptive. And in this context, then the Buddha gave him the teachings which are unique to the Buddhas. And what he taught was he taught him about, or I would say he didn't teach him, he probably pointed him to see for himself the world of impermanence. He said, he taught Yasa, this is suffering, this is the arising of suffering, and this is the ceasing of suffering. The suffering you have, the stress you have, the distress you have, yes, it's there, can be there, but it's not permanent, it's not fixed, nothing is stuck there. It appears and it disappears. And if you're not seeing things through the filter of your stories, story-making mind, if you're really present in a very quiet, still mind that just sees, you can see that a story gets born and a story ceases. You can see that an emotion arises and it passes. You can see that the idea of me as a story maker, me as the self, is a sense, a feeling, an idea that arises and ceases. And so Yasa was pointing him to what some people call as the river of life, that our life is just flowing if we're very present. And we allow things to flow and move without trying to hold on to the river or dam the rivers, block the river. As soon as we try to block it or hold on to it, we don't really have a river anymore. And then it's a lot of work. And the image I have for this idea, a little different than a river, is imagine you live inside a room, inside a house, it has a beautiful window, it has a beautiful view, natural setting, maybe outside the window there's a nice river and trees and birds and butterflies and life and whatever. Big, big, you know, window, your living room. However, the blind is always pulled down. Big white blind is pulled down. And the blind is kind of like a, you know, movie screen. And in fact, there's always a movie going on that blind. And it's the movie of, it's the movie of your stories. Movie of your past, as you reconstruct it. And the movie of your future, as you construct it. Movie of what's happening in the world, as you construct it. And it's so repetitive. You know, you don't really, the same movie is showing on that, on the blinds, you know, a lot. And so you live with, you know, watching that movie. But then someone comes along and they lift up the blinds. And finally you look out the window and you see everything is changing and moving and the seasons and there's a whole different thing. And it's always changing, the natural world. It's a whole different world that you're living in. So this is what the Buddha did for Yasa, as he pointed Yasa to the arising and ceasing, rising and passing, the impermanence, especially of suffering, especially of the ways in which we feel caught in this life. To see it as a part of the river, the flow of impermanence, moving and changing and moving and changing. You know, the blinds were lifted and Yasa could see. In fact, the texts say that then Yasa, his Dharma eye awoke. He got a new eye, the Dharma eye, where he could see more clearly what's really going on here. And in that Dharma eye, Yasa then had a different exclamation. Rather than exclaiming, oh, it's oppressive, it's dangerous, it's a calamity, Yasa exclaimed, whatever has the nature to arise has the nature to pass away. And with that, Yasa became enlightened. Something about, so letting the stories drop, and the storyteller even see, the storyteller rises in passing, the end of the storyteller. We don't have to tell stories anymore. In order to become free, in order to let go, in order to attain this quality of peace. And probably that's what the Buddha meant when he said, this is not a calamity, this is not oppressive, this is not a danger. This life, this world, us, when we're able to let go and not cling and hold on to anything in this river of our experience that's arising and passing, moving through us all the time. So the end of the storyteller. So I hope that you can lift your blinds one of these days. All the way. Some of you have peaked, but lift them all the way up. So, thank you all.